What were some of your experiences with SLAM? Like, what years were you in SLAM, or what was the time period that you were in SLAM?
Well, it's been 10 years, and I think, well, SLAM recruited me in the fall of, 99, soon after I enrolled in Hunter College in CUNY. And, I was recruited to help organize and do outreach, you know, to students through, the City University of New York. I was 20 years old. That was prior to, R2K, only a few months prior to R2K. Yeah, that's when I first got into contact with SLAM.
Cool. Did you, were you part of, like, the mobilizations around, the killing of Amadou Diallo?
Yeah, that was one of the, issues that, that I helped mobilize for. It was student rights, access to education, and also SLAM had a campaign against police brutality around that area, around that that time. Prior to that, was Abner Louima, and then Amadou Diallo happened, I think, around that time as well. I remember going up to Elder Avenue in the Bronx and supporting some high school students as well. They were having some protests and rallies up there. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, didn't we also do some civil disobedience around the Brooklyn, in the Brooklyn Bridge? Was that before Philadelphia? Or I think it was before Philly. When this pretty sizable rally downtown, and some students and some members of SLAM also, they chained themselves to the street lights, and they were able to block the bridge for a few minutes, and they got pretty good media coverage, you know. And it was I remember specifically that I was protesting against police brutality. Yeah. So I helped to do outreach for that and organize a little bit as well. Yeah, that was prior to R2K.
Yeah, I was really inspired by the work with college and high school students working together to mobilize, like, young people in general from New York. When in my discussion with Kaid, like, she was talking about how, like, in the months leading up to R2K, she was part of the discussions about the focus of it, and she really argued for the focus to be on police and prisons. And because of that, I feel like we all really, it might have appealed to us more because we were already, you know, doing that work, and that was really important to us. Was that part of why you wanted to go to Philly?
Yeah, that's very true. We had a strong sentiment in solidarity with Brother Mumia. That's around the time in which I got to know of him, actually. I think I learned about him, yeah, when I was 19 or 20, and I was we really felt, you know, that he was a symbol of the abuse of the state against, you know, dissent, and it was very appropriate that we should all go to Philadelphia and raise awareness, you know, about George Bush Jr. coming into office and the fact that they were holding Brother Mumia in Philadelphia, right? And how he's from there, and he worked there, and just kept him there all this time. So, yeah, I do remember that we had a strong emphasis. We had a strong commitment to raise awareness about the prison industrial complex, and I remember learning a lot about that issue months prior to R2K. And that was for sure one of our main focus, you know, going into the protest in Philadelphia.
What was your experience of the August 1st day of action? Like, what was your, you know, story of the version of the events that you were part of?
I was hanging out with somewhat like the legal team as well. I'm somewhat legally oriented or legally minded, and I remember because of my status, I was undocumented at that time, and I had thought that I shouldn't really risk arrest, because, you know, I would face, you know, imminent deportation. So I was I was doing legal support, and I was somewhat rolling with the legal team. And during the day of the actions, I would be mostly in the periphery of. I was sort of like a double agent in the sense that I got dressed as a reporter, you know, and I got my my indie media ID, and I have some other ID from a New Jersey newspaper, and I had a camera on me and a couple other things, and I was dressed somewhat as a reporter, and I remember I was in the periphery of the flying squad, one of the flying squads that was actually a decoy to try to buy some time for another flying squad that was going to do the blockade, trying to block some streets. So once everything started, once you see your friends being attacked by the police, it's within you to just kind of get involved. Even though I didn't really plan to do any direct action, I was part of some of that as well, you know, which is really risky, but, it felt like it was necessary at the time, you know. Once you're put in that situation, you just want to look out for your buddy, you know. So I would do that, and then when the police would come, I would just go to the side and wipe the sweat off my face and just kind of like, you know, take some pictures, and they would walk, they would run right by me and chase, you know, the people who were moving, and I would just kind of like stand still and just wait for that melee to go by, and then join them, you know, a couple blocks down the road, and that was more or less how we did it during those couple of days. I didn't commit any crimes, I didn't see any crimes committed except those being perpetrated by the police.
If you had any pictures like that you took that you wanted to share, I'd love to.
No, I had a fake camera, so I didn't take any pictures.
Oh!
I wasn't really taking, it was just a decoy for protection, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Wow. So what were you doing in the legal, in your legal capacity? You were helping, like, being a legal observer or?
Yeah, no, I was, as soon as the arrest started, I would, after the day was done, we would have dinner, and then Emily Kaye would do it as well. She's the one that got me inside the legal room. And once they got to know me, then I was able to walk in by myself. But, I initially started going with her. But we'd just go back at night and just try to file everything that came in during the day, you know, because the legal office is very crowded during the day. It's full of lawyers and paralegals and people helping out. They were pretty well staffed. But then at night, it was somewhat understaffed. You know, people went home, and there was only a couple people there. So that was, I remember spending a few nights there, just filing things, you know, all the reports that would come in from the day, I would just file them and put them in the right category. So by the time the lawyers and the paralegals came back the next morning, they would find everything, in order, you know, so they would be able to move a little faster.
Oh, that's amazing. So you're talking about during the time when people were in jail and they were calling and
reporting? Yeah. As soon as that started. As soon as I started. We also went around, as soon as the arrest started, we also went around the precincts, and that's when I played somewhat of a lawyer character. And I didn't introduce myself as a lawyer, but I definitely acted as if I was representing some of these people that were, you know, in jail. And we were trying to get a head count and trying to get some names of who was being held where. So we would, you know, we'd go around from precinct to precinct and just come in, and I would go down with my briefcase and just, you know, ask if I could talk to some of the kids that were arrested. And, you know, I had to talk to the parents. They were very nervous. They wanted to speak to their children. And, you know, sometimes I would get some cooperation. Most of the time I wouldn't. And we would also take that back to the legal office, you know, and try to do away with with double postings and try to cross information, you know, because at the first day or two, it was somewhat nerve-wracking for the people, of course, for the people on the inside, and also for the people on the outside and the parents as well, because we didn't know. We didn't know where people were being held. We didn't know how they were treated. You know, we didn't know. A lot of people had medical restrictions and dietary restrictions, and because a lot of the people inside, in order to protect some of the more vulnerable protesters, they were exercising, they were withholding their names, you know. They weren't giving
right.
their names, so they weren't, because of that, they weren't giving their phone calls. So there was a lot of that going on during the first few days. So, yeah, I remember going around to the precincts and trying to get some information. A couple of things did happen. I remember, unbeknownst to us, after leaving one of the precincts, we found out, I think, months later, that after we visited a precinct, apparently the cops there thought that, I was a representative of the people that were being inside, and they were probably minors, if I had to guess, and they got really scared, and they let a good bunch, I think they let like a good dozen people just out immediately after I visited them, just because I knew they were doing
wow.
something illegal, and they had no proof against these kids, you know. So some things did work, you know, but then you don't really get to know those things until after the fact. And the people inside as well, I mean, they, as soon as they hear, you know, because there's people coming in as well, you know, people that are just being arrested for some other stuff, and they come in and they talk, you know, and they say, well, there's people out there waiting, they have fines, you know, and that also helps for those that are being held.
It was pretty intense, like some of the stories of what was happening inside. I mean, how did that impact you when you were doing, you know, legal support, like just hearing some of these stories of what was happening to people inside?
Well, yeah, we had a sense that, you know, we were in for a really tough fight. You know, prior to that, I think, I forget which protest was it. It was a significant one. Why? But in Seattle, I think, in which, yeah, less than a year prior to RTK, you know, Seattle happened, and they also, you know, rounded up a few hundred. But in that instance, you know, everybody was let free. You know, a lot of them didn't give their names, and after two or three days stalemate, they were all released, you know, under their own recognizance, and it was more of a victory for the protesters, right? Going into Philadelphia, we had hoped that it was going to be a similar instance. So as the days passed one by one, we realized that it wasn't going to be like that. Right? It was going to be the complete opposite. Right. So
right.
That's when we started running into some trouble, and you know, the resources started to deteriorate. We hadn't, you know, we had hoped that we were going to see a similar scenario as in Seattle, and it wasn't. You know, they were playing hardball, and they weren't letting anybody out. They wasn't given their name, and the access that they gave to the lawyers was very limited. You know, and as people came out, we would hear very, very gruesome stories of, you know, physical abuse and mental abuse and sexual abuse. You know, and yeah, so we had to somewhat, you know, readjust. You know? Some people were being hit with astronomical. Some of the people's bails were set, I think, like $1 million. Was it a bail for somebody
yeah.
that just trying to block traffic? So they were definitely trying to drain the movement's pocket. You know, it was a different scenario. It was a few hard days after. Very, very tough, 2-3 weeks after August 1st, you know.
Do you have anything you would like to say about as far as, like, you know, what we were doing, like, tactically and strategically, if you would say that there's some lessons of what we could have done differently, or, like, you know, really lessons, any lessons of what we did right or anything in particular like that that you would want to share, especially with the young people who are sort of where we were at then?
Yeah. Well, I think some of the things that we learned or that we noticed somewhat, we didn't have a lot of community support, you know. I think we could have had some more. There was somewhat of an oversight in everyone's part, actually, people from Philadelphia and people coming from, say, like New York and all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. This is just my personal opinion, but I felt that residents from Philadelphia didn't really know what we were doing there. You know, people, working class folk in Philly didn't really know what we were doing there, and it was traumatizing for them as well, I think. And I saw it in the streets during those days of direct action, you know, because the aim was to disrupt the city, no more business as usual. And unfortunately, working class people, I mean, you know, we live on a, check, what do you call it, we live from check to check, so it's really troublesome if you can't get to work that night. It can cost you your job, you know. If you're late for work that night, and I remember seeing people very upset in the street, you know, when there were huge traffic jams. There's a lot of outsiders, people that weren't even from Philly, and they were, you know, they had, you know, just pretty much caused a big headache for people that were trying to get to work, people that were trying to get their children to childcare, and there was some of that that went on that made me feel that we didn't have a lot of community support. You understand? And I think some discussions were made after the fact that that's something, you know, one of the lessons to be learned is to do that, maybe to do more groundwork, more community work before organizing such a big action, in a sense, because it's, and ultimately the people that are going to be affected the most are always the people on the bottom, right? So,
right.
I felt that it's really hard to, I mean, if it is true that, I mean, as working class people, we don't, you know, you don't have time to organize. Maybe you have family and you have 2-3 jobs and you may not have time to, even though you understand the need, and you may be in agreement with the slogans of the movement. Physically, you can develop any time, but if you're made aware of what's going on, you can plan around it at least. You know, if you know what's happening on the first and the second, you can maybe plan around it. Not necessarily get involved. The repercussions could be dire, but. I think that we could have done a better job. We could have done a better job letting people know what was going to happen, on August 1st and August 2nd, you know, and what kind of police repression was going to happen as well, you know, on Sunday night and all that. I think there was a lot of people that didn't know and they started to look at us as a nuisance, you know, rather than freedom fighters, people interested in social justice. So, you know, in the that's just some things that we have to look at, you know, for future endeavors.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said that, because that's how I felt too at that time. Like you would look at the media and you realize, like, the people in the city, like, aren't hearing from us. They're only hearing from the media, and so we don't have the support, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's expected. You can't expect the corporate media to cover protests of your point of view. But, you know, before the fact, things could be done, you know, knowing that we're going to have a media whitewash, you know, doing the actions.
I feel like I might have skipped over that part from August 1st when you were in the streets and you said that the only crime you saw was what the police were doing to people, and I was just wondering if there was anything you wanted to add about, like, what you saw the police doing, like, were they hurting people on the street that you saw?
Well, I mean, Philadelphia wasn't in a more or less passive state of siege, you know, by the police. I mean, you couldn't be a regular citizen that day. If you were under suspicion of anything, you would get picked up. You know, people got picked up crossing the street, and they weren't even part of the protests. You know, the police were very aggressive in that. Well, if you were even around any sort of protesting, you were immediately, you know, cuffed and put in a paddy wagon. You know, you weren't even your Miranda rights weren't respected. They didn't give you a phone call. It was pretty, you know, it's pretty dictatorial. You know, it was like. Civil rights were somewhat suspended for a day or two if you were in Philadelphia, you know, because the police were scared, you know, they were afraid. And they, when they get afraid, they would be repressed, you know, violently. And, yeah, I mean, I saw people get pushed and punched and, you know, handcuffed just for being around. I mean, people that were exercising their freedom, you know, the First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech, they would stand in that corner and yell some slogans, they would get bomb rushed by a police. I mean, resembling some sort of, you know, sort of police state, you know. And, I mean, things like that were, civil rights definitely were not respected in those 2 days. You know, some of the lessons to be learned are also when actions happen, you know, the police are going to overreact. And you're the ones that are always going to riot, you know.
Right.
The protesters, the people just pretty much react to the violence that is being inflicted upon them, you know. So say if I get to a corner and I start yelling "Free Mumia," and then all of a sudden I'm in handcuffs, you know. So, completely illegal, you know, completely illegal and bogus, and but yeah, they ruin your week, you know, they ruin your weekend because they'll charge you, you know, they'll bomb rush you and charge you, and they'll charge you with assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest, and it's your word against the word of 3 or 4 cops, and if you don't have it on video, you know, yeah, you're in trouble, you know.
Yeah.
Luckily, a lot of those charges were dropped, you know. Nowadays, you know, I mean, I think it's more important, even though we're going against, yeah, still, we're going against batons and firearms. You know, if the Black Panthers, you know, I think Bobby Seale said that, right? If the Black Panthers carried logbooks and handguns, you know, we should be carrying, you know, video cameras and laptops. Or, you know, everybody should have on them, you know, some sort of video device that they can easily take out of their pockets and start to record with audio, you know. We're seeing more and more cases being dropped, and we're seeing civil lawsuits being won because of video, you know. And that's very important, you know, for activists to keep in mind that things need to be documented, you know, visually, you know, and that can give you, you know, we're talking about a nonviolent direct action, nonviolent movement, you know, that exercises civil disobedience. I think it's somebody who is even responsible to go out there with a, you know, a video camera and, you know, an audio. You know, so when they come and they violate your rights, you can get on tape. You know, and yeah, months, maybe even years down the line in the courtroom, yeah, those things are going to be useful.
I feel like you answered all my questions, but is there anything that that you would like to add?
In terms of young people today, it's been 10 years since that happened, you know, and I think we just need to be more tolerant with each other, more understanding, you know, within the movement, you know. I was just recently, I took my mother for her birthday. We went down to Washington, D.C. For the 1 million Immigrant March on March 21st of this year, a few months back. And so we went down there, just her and I. We linked up with a community group from Queens that I have some have a liaison with. And yeah, it was pretty impressive, you know, seeing a 250,000 people there, you know, in Washington, you know, protesting and coming together. But as you know, as we were standing there, you realize that it's really, yeah, it's 250,000 people, you know, divided into 5,000 groups, you know, and we don't have, there wasn't a feeling of unison, of unity. There wasn't a feeling of there's a speaker on the podium and everyone's listening and people are agreeing with whatever the speaker is saying. It seemed to me that the groups only listened and clapped if the person that was speaking was their leader. You understand? I mean, throughout the day, there were about 20 speakers, you know, of different, you know, different caliber, different political associations, different ranks, some congressmen, some community-based leaders, you know, some more high-profile national organizers, and it seemed to me that people were just waiting for their you know, whoever they knew, more or less, to get on the podium, and then they could, you know, cheer them on, and whenever, and then they would just turn, and whenever the next speaker came up, they would turn away and, you know, have some food and just talk and just do something else. And but I didn't hear not one speaker that was able to unite the whole crowd, not even once, right? Every once in a while, people try to have some sort of some sort of unison and a united message, but it was very hard. It's very hard to do. And, you know, we're very intolerant. We're very intolerant these days. We need to work on our understanding, you know, that this is going to take, it's going to take some time. It's not going to, when I was 20, yeah, I also did think that we were going to have immediate change, you know, a year and 2 years. But really, I mean, it takes a lifetime. It takes several years to see change, you know. And a lot of times, it's really hard to see the advance. But there is advance. Things are getting. I think that you know, there's a. I'm seeing the movement is even stronger than it was before. But it's just very compartmentalized. You know, we're very picky, in a sense, you know, somewhat sectarian, in a sense, and we're not, we have to work on that, you know, as a movement, as a people, you know, find some common denominators that can allow us to move forward, you know, en masse, you know, with big numbers, strong, you know? And that's more or less what I'm thinking these days.